How's it going? Thanks very much for joining me, Leah. Can you just do us a favor for anyone who doesn't know you? Can you just kind of give us a bit of an idea of what you do and your background and so on?
Sure. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and so I do talk therapy, and I also do a lot of work with ketamine therapy and psychedelic integration therapy as part of my practice. Yeah, that's basically it.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so how did you get into therapy as like a career? What was like the path that got you there?
Luckily, it was something I knew from a young age, and so I went to school for that, and yeah, so just kind of have been following that path. And it's beautiful work. I love working with people. I like helping people to heal and awaken, and especially since I've started incorporating more of the psychedelic work into my practice, it's really feeling just so aligned with my own path and what I think is the way to really deep true healing for people.
I see. I see. You mentioned that the type of therapy you do mainly is like talk therapy. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of like maybe like the more what like the main approaches to therapy would be and kind of how you land on talk therapy, why that's the one to focus on?
I'm technically my approach is psychodynamic, but it's really all very intuitive. I do a lot of work with people around helping them to become more aware of how their thinking mind or ego affects their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and to begin to transcend that ego constriction that's holding them back. Yeah, so it's a lot of kind of just going on the premise that all humans have a feeling of emptiness, of unlovability, of unworthiness, that's kind of a void inside of us, and that so much of our behavior is really trying to avoid having to feel that emptiness and to find ways to avoid that, the void inside of us through consumption of media, drugs, alcohol, shopping, all of those things. Even just in the way that we communicate with people, it's so much around defending against feeling unlovable or unworthy. And so when you can kind of make peace with that part of yourself and understand all of the ways that you're defending against it, you can really create new neural pathways, new ways of existing. I kind of think of it's like the ultimate neurohacking is understanding those unconscious processes that are existing within us and making them conscious and finding peace with them, ways to integrate those parts of ourselves and to create new ways of being.
Interesting. You touched on a word there that I'd imagine is very important in therapy, ego, but it's also a word that gets kind of thrown around a lot, I think, in just common parlance, you know. It can just get used like to mean whatever people want it to mean. Can you take us through what your understanding of what ego is?
That's a really good question because it is a word that a lot of people have different meanings behind. The way that when I say ego, what I'm talking about is the thinking mind, the mind that is our ego is our friend. It's so often people are like, I want to kill the ego death, all of that. But the ego is such a beautiful part of being human. It's what gives us language. It's what helps us to create patterns and formulate ideas and share ideas. But it's, what is it they say? Well, it's a wonderful tool. I can't remember the saying, but it's a wonderful tool, but it's a terrible master, something like that. In that, when it's just an unconscious expression of the ego self, we are just like being animated by our own unconscious traumatic processes rather than having more ownership over ourselves, you know. And it's, everything's kind of an interplay between ego and more of a more intuitive sense of just our humanness. And so when you can see the ego in all of the ways it's kind of playing tricks on our minds, you can begin to pull it to the side and be in more of a space where you have a clearer connection to your intuitive mind, to other dimensions of existence, just to a larger perspective on your own humanity and experience as of being human.
I see. This may be kind of broad, but can you maybe give us some, I guess, some like real life examples, maybe some you've come across with therapy clients of how ego kind of gets in the way of, I don't know, like a happy life or a fulfilled life, something like that. I know it's a fairly, I'm kind of looking for specifics, but.
Yeah. Okay. What's a good example? Well, what's any behavior? Like, can you give me an example of a behavior that you have that you're like, why do I do this? Like, this is kind of getting in the way. Can you think of anything like that?
I suppose sometimes in interactions with others, especially maybe people who, whose like opinions I care about, or maybe people you don't know, you might kind of look back on the way you acted and kind of think, okay, yeah, I was kind of doing that like to maybe to impress them or to show like a strong side of me instead of a weak side, something like that. I think with men, especially like, ego can be, yeah, I'm struggling. You know, it can be attached to like your sense of masculinity or kind of how much of a man you are or aren't.
Yeah. That's a great example. And I mean, I think everybody kind of does that. Everybody kind of puts on this, you know, version of ourselves. There's many masks that we wear, and that's part of existing in the world. But it also, there's times when you look back and you're like, why acting in that way, you know? So then you'd kind of say, so I was really trying to make that person think I was strong. Why am I doing that? You know? And then it's like, what's happening is there's often like a layer of people pleasing, you know, I want to control this dynamic with somebody by behaving in a way that I think is going to get a good, response from them, right? And so in that interplay, which is like one of the most common things that people do, it gives us a sense of control over the dynamic. You know, when we can craft ourselves to be something that we think will be well received, which of course is just part of being human, like we all do that and it's fine. But when we're crafting a slightly false version of ourselves in order to be well received, we're actually creating within that dynamic sort of a toxic element, because we aren't allowing ourselves to be fully seen. And often that is because of perhaps some fear of shame and embarrassment if we were more authentic. And underneath the shame and embarrassment, at least in the way that I formulate, I know a lot of people have other ways of formulating, is often then that layer of, you know, if I feel the shame and embarrassment, then I'm going to go underneath it and see that I am afraid that I'm going to be unworthy. I'm going to be unlovable. I'm going to be rejected by the other, you know? So those defensive behaviors and those masks that we create give a sense of control, not only of the way the other person perceives us, but of our own self-esteem. If our self-esteem is based upon the perception of others, which for most people, it is. Most people, our self-esteem is based on our productivity, the ways that we are judged by the outside world. You know, like you're saying, I want to be seen as strong. And so that often can get into this complicated dynamic where my strength is based on how others perceive me to be rather than how I feel in my own strength, you know, because your own strength would come from a lot of things, but from your own authentic self and from really feeling like this is me and I'm not afraid to maybe embarrass myself or to, you know, have this other person reject me. Still be okay even with that rejection.
I was going to say, yeah, like if it comes from like your own, like within, then someone can't grant it to you or someone can't take it away to,
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so much of my practice is working with people around hyperproductivity, you know, just people that are successful. We have, you know, that some flavors of perfectionism, some flavors of hyperproductivity, of wanting to achieve, which is a beautiful thing. And we don't want to get rid of that completely. But the danger is when we have our productivity based on the way that others perceive us. And so if we don't live up to some benchmark that we've set for ourselves, often based on other people's ideals, you know, just what society expects of us, then we feel like I'm unworthy. So what I try to help people do is to rewrite that narrative so that you can still continue to do all the things that you feel called to do, but to also have more empathy for yourself when you don't, you know, hit that benchmark, that you can say, oh, I feel a little ashamed or embarrassed that I didn't get it, but I'm still a worthy person, even in the absence of meeting that goal.
Right. That's interesting what you mentioned about kind of high achiever, high performer types. America, I grew up in Ireland, like, but America is very much known for being like the land of like where some people at least like work every hour of the day, fucking commute like 3 hours to work while working on the commute, you know, very, very productivity, work focused. Among those people who come to you for therapy who would fit that type, are there like common themes or things they're dealing with or doubts or something that they have? Is there any like patterns that kind of repeat themselves?
I mean, I think at least in this culture, almost everybody has some of that, because we are programmed to believe that the key to happiness is hitting these benchmarks, you know, and there's this idea of what makes a good life that's given to us by our society, by our leaders, by our families, by the media and TV, you know? And so there's a lot of people that get to a point in their life where they say, oh, okay, I did all of those things. I have everything, but I still don't have a deep sense of satisfaction. And so often what we find is that when you're doing things for the other, when you're doing things to be seen in a certain way, you really lose touch with your own internal wants and needs. You know, that is the intuitive mind that just gets kind of shut off in people, that inner sense of what do I really want? Like, what's right for me? You know, I have friends, clients, I've seen it myself at times. Just it's so common in people where it's like, what do you want right now? Like, what do you need? And people kind of don't know, because they're so used to being like, I should, my partner wants me to do this. This is my responsibility, you know, and our lives just get filled with these moments of doing what we think we should be doing more so than what is truly in our alignment.
Actually, yeah. Now you mentioned that there's a lot of these kind of like online sort of male spaces. I don't know if you've heard of this like Andrew Tate guy and the kind of stuff around that, but like a lot of that is preaching to young men that the way to like measure like successful life is lots of money, you're driving a sports car, and getting loads of women. They're kind of like you know, it's like material and getting loads of women. And that's I think that's like exactly what you said. These like benchmarks that are kind of set by other people that fellas are chasing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's like and then the idea is, and then you will be happy. And I mean, it's even interesting to me. So often then with clients who are like, okay, I have these things, I don't feel happy. And then we'll start to kind of work on this. But then it's like, oh, but I'm still not happy all the time. And it's just interesting that sort of life sells us this idea that we should be happy all the time. But the reality is that's impossible. Like I'll always say to clients, like I can help you to not feel like you have an anxiety disorder, but I'm never going to make it so you don't feel anxiety sometimes. You know, like we are humans that have this wide spectrum of emotion, but so much of it has just been, humans are allowed to exist in this very small aperture of emotion where we're not supposed to be too happy and we're not supposed to be too sad. So, you know, we're kind of missing out on the experience of life is so much about the journey, you know, and it's about the ups and downs and learning from that. But we're kind of given this idea of this very linear path with objectively based goals that is going to give us satisfaction and happiness. But I mean, when you look around, people have those things and they might have a smile on their face sometimes, but they're really not usually feeling deeply satisfied, because the ups and downs of life feel like failures. Their emotional ups and downs feel like failures rather than just interesting experiences as part of being human.
Right. Okay. Interesting. You said that the type of therapy you do is talk therapy. We're obviously doing this by Zoom. Sometimes I do interviews in person. For you, is there any difference as a therapist? Is it like easier or more difficult to like give therapy to someone in person or across like what we're doing?
I mean, I prefer in person. I think that there's, you know, a lot of magic that comes to just being in somebody's energy in the same room, but I do a lot of work on Zoom just because that's the world we live in. And I have clients that don't live that close to me. And, you know, a lot of people are working, even if they're working from home. So they just have these little pockets of time. I mean, it's just one of the things about where we are in society right now, that there's pluses and minuses, but it just kind of is what it is. It's what we have. And it is a good tool. You know, we can communicate with people that maybe we wouldn't be able to have the time to if we had to travel. So
yeah, it's definitely better than nothing. But yeah, I much prefer interviews in person. Like you said, just being someone. I mean, I know we're looking at each other, but like making eye contact with someone who's actually in the room with you. It's a very different thing. Okay, so one of the, I suppose, I don't know, maybe it's like a stereotype around therapy, but one of the ideas around it is that like it's always like addressing a trauma. There's always like something bad that happened or bad instances that happened that you're trying to patch up or something like that. Is that the case in reality?
Okay, well, that's such a good question. And I have a two-part answer for that. One is that I think all humans have a certain level of emotional trauma. And I mean, trauma is such like an umbrella term at this point, but we all have that, like I was saying, that inner wounding around not being valuable or not being lovable. And I think that it doesn't always have to do with the parents not being enough. It more so is just a developmental phase where there's a time in childhood where children are so egocentric that they believe everything that happens is because of them, you know? So the parent can say, oh, you know, the parent can be even just the parent's upset, the parent's having a bad day. And the child is just going to think, this is because of me. I did something wrong. And they're going to hold the parent on a pedestal as an idealized parent. So it's going to just be internalized as something's wrong with me. Something's not enough with me. If I could change this behavior in myself, my parent would be happy. So I think we all have that kind of internal conflict, because when we were creating these schemas about how to understand ourselves and dynamic to others, that is the mindset that we were in. So that's always going to be part of the process. Is, I mean, I think of it as like, that's, we have the hardware of our mind, our ego, our body. And then there's all this software that gets downloaded on it. And you kind of need to just update that software as you evolve, you know, because we're often still running on software from our childhood. That's just this unconscious process. Whereas if we really could open it up and look at it in our adult mind, we'd say, well, of course, that wasn't my fault that my parent did that thing when I was eight. But if you don't go back and kind of update that, the programming, you're still operating from that space of wounding. But then the other part is, it can't be all dealing with the trauma, you know, it's because we all have it, and it's this infinite thing, and it's very interesting, and it's good to kind of create new frameworks to understand it. So when it comes up, you can work with it. You know, the frameworks, as I imagine them, are, you know, just not being afraid to feel the feeling, not being afraid to look and say, where did that feeling come from in my childhood, that I can then kind of rework. But we also have to really come from a top down, like that's kind of going through the bottom. It's going through the darkness, which is very important, but also being in a space of really appreciating how far we've come, you know, who we are as a person today, all of the strengths that we have, and even those shadowy bits, just really being able to say, it's okay that I have that. And I don't have to solve it all today. I don't have to have it all figured out. I don't have to go and go in a deep, dark dive if I don't want to. You know, because so much of this type of work is also the, like they call the golden shadow, you know, what are the strengths I have that I've been hiding from the world because I'm afraid of my own power and my own light, you know? And so much of it can be just that. It's just finding more love and empathy and the ability to feel joy more deeply. You know, we have to feel those more negatively valued, difficult emotions, but we also have to find space to feel the positive ones and to be okay with loving ourselves and just celebrating life.
Yeah, it's funny. Among among men, the second thing you touched on, the allowing yourself to kind of feel the more kind of warm, fuzzy kind of stuff, and like expressing love, or expressing like some kind of vulnerability or something among men, especially. I mean, I obviously as a guy, you spend more time with guys, but like that really rings true. Like guys in particular often won't let themselves express or kind of feel something that's deemed kind of soft or more feminine. I did want to ask you before. Do you vary like approach to therapy according to whether the client's like a man or a woman? Do you think there's like broadly different ways to go about giving therapy to guys or ladies?
I don't know if I necessarily would say it's different completely based on the sex of the person. I would say it's more about just where that person is in their own journey and, you know, what their level of comfort is, you know, because you kind of have to find the person where they are and help them to just maybe take a little step, you know. So it's more about just aligning with the individual and where they are. But if there is definitely a piece of understanding what it's like to grow up in a society as a man or a woman and being aware of those things, like you're saying, that so often with men, it's like, yeah, I get it. You've been programmed since childhood to believe that your feelings are something to be repressed, you know? So it's often even more buried, those positive or negative emotions, and just, you know, having empathy for how deep that programming goes and how difficult it is to be okay with being a human being that has feelings and emotional states.
It's well known. I think it's fair to say it's true that women, that men like kind of don't talk about, a bad time they're going through, or bad mental health or bad feelings. And women much more so, like, will with their friends, they'll talk about it. Whereas with guys, like, a lot of the time anyway, like a fella could be going through like the worst time of his life, and his friend asked him how are you doing, and he's like, yeah, fine, yeah, I'm grand, and that's kind of it. do you think do you have any thoughts as to why that is? Why women are kind of, I don't know, feel more free to talk about it, and why they do?
I mean, yeah, it's definitely true. I think it's just the way that we've been programmed for a long, long time, you know, and we're in a space where consciousness is evolving. You know, we're more and more people are seeing the value in using their emotional states as a compass to understand what's not working in their life and what is working. But if when you look back in past generations, you know, there was no space for that. And especially when you go back further to a place where men were, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, of course, there are women working too, or even in, you know, the Agricultural Revolution, men, we were just spending their entire days working in manual labor. And, you know, in for many of them, you know, it just working, working, working. That was, you know, there was such a thing for that. And it goes back a long time. And so if you're in a space where you're just constantly, you know, driving with something so physically demanding or, you know, that just requires all of your focus, there's not a lot of space for thinking about your thoughts and thinking about your feelings. And it would be a real liability to be a man in that sort of setting who's feeling their emotions and crying. I mean, there would be no space for that at the workplace. And so, you know, in those times, women were more in the household, taking care of children, where there's, I'd say there was probably a little more wiggle room for, you know, reflecting on your experience of life, you know, a little
Empathy
more
too.
time for talking. I mean, it might be the way that we're wired too, but I think that the ways that what's been expected of us physically and societally has affected the consciousness evolution. And, you know, now we're in a space where so many people do have more time to think, and also more access to ideas, you know, through the internet, especially. You know, there's just space to evolve that wasn't necessarily there even 10, 20 years ago. You know, the mental space and then the invitation that's offered through seeing other people that are having these new ways of thinking.
Do you think like fundamentally men and women have like different ways of expressing emotion, or is it kind of the same, and we're just kind of like taught differently?
I mean, I would say there's probably fundamentally. I think that there's definitely physiological, hormonal, biological differences between men and women, and just what we have had, you know, selecting evolution selected over time to favor people who are going to function in a certain way that maybe fits more with societal ideals. So, you know, I don't, if none of this human evolution had happened, there would probably still be some biological difference, but I think that the difference in how it's expressed, but I would think that the need to process and understand emotion would be there for both groups, and especially just to the extent that you can use it as a way to kind of divine what your needs are. You know, if you're feeling like your life feels empty and you're always down and you just don't feel inspired, well, what is that speaking to? What is the lack in your life? What is it that you need to find space for? You know, how do you find that space to feel creative and inspired? And what is it that's happening in the way that your life is now that you don't have any space for that? You know, just like stuff like that.
Another kind of, I guess, kind of a stereotype or cliche is that some people would say women are emotional and men aren't, and others would say women men and women, it's not like men aren't emotional, but women are way more so. Do you think that's true in your experience? Are women like more emotional? You know, it could just be down to like brain chemistry, but did you get that statement through?
I mean, I don't have extensive knowledge on the physiological aspects of emotion between the sexes. But, you know, like I said, I think that it's so much of it is programming. So much of it is, as we exist, so much of who we are is a reflection of the way that we're received by the world around us. You know, our entire, like what we think of as our personalities are really just crafted based on how we bump up against people, how our parents perceive us, how our peers are, you know, childhood friends. Just it's all an experiment. And when you put something out and you get something back, it's going to reinforce that behavior or create extinction in that behavior. So if you're a person who, when you express emotion, your, you know, primary caregiver in childhood is not able to receive that, or they shame you for that, you're going to take that information and, like we were saying, probably turn it against yourself, say something's wrong with me, but then also find ways to contort yourself to be closer to what you believe is going to be well received by those important people in your life.
To be fair, a lot of the things men do when they get like really emotional, very often they won't be it won't be described as like them acting emotional. It'll be, oh, he was angry, he was raging, or he was mad, instead of like that guy was acting emotional. It's funny
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
they're almost like separate. They're almost seen as like separate things, you know. So to be fair, I think. Just my own experience. I think women are. I think it's fair to say that in general, women are more emotional. But then again, like with guys, and this isn't too common, but like it's not uncommon either, where like two guys who don't know each other bump into each other, and like a minute later, they're fighting. Someone's seriously injured, or someone's dead, you know. So it kind of comes out in different ways.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, that's for men, there's more. A man shows anger. Well, maybe somebody would say to him, oh, that was too much. But at the same time, they're not going to shame him for not being manly, you know, in the same way they might if he cried when the thing happened. So, you know, the emotions have to go somewhere. And the ways that the people around you allow you to express them are going to be the ways that you're going to be more likely to, you know, and then the flip side of that is often that women have a difficult time being comfortable with their own anger and rage because, you know, that's just seen as too threatening from a woman. And, you know, that they're much more encouraged by the sad feelings. And it's easy to find people who want to, you know, give a child a hug when they're sad, but a child who's raging is going to have less of a positive experience with people around them, in general.
Right.
But for boys, they're often not going to even find that kind of comfort with the sadness because it's just going to be shamed as being, you know, not tough or whatever.
Right. This isn't something that I agree with, but again, it's something I've heard. It's something I've heard quite a bit. There's some that would say that therapy isn't good for you, because what you're doing is you're just kind of like wallowing in your own emotions, and you're kind of dwelling on stuff, and you're kind of telling yourself that there's something wrong with me. You're kind of like you're getting a diagnosis, and now it's like, oh, well, I've got this, so there is something. And what would you say to that?
I actually think that is totally it can be true. And I like the way that you're describing it is exactly a thing that can happen to people, which is you can enter therapy and just get solidified in your victim mentality. You know, it's and that is not productive. And there's a lot of you hear a lot of stories of people having that kind of experience in therapy where they just are getting a lot of empathy from their therapist, but maybe not much challenging. And so they just really hold on even tighter to this idea of being a victim. And most humans kind of like being victims. Most humans, as much as people will say they want to have power, to really be a sovereign individual and to step into your power means that you're responsible for not only the things that you do well, but also for your mistakes. And most people prefer to exist in a way where when they make mistakes, there's somebody that they can point a finger at, you know? And it's just much more comfortable when life doesn't go your way to say, it's not because of me. It's because of the circumstances. It's because these things happen to me. And of course, there is truth to that for some people. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to just over-apply that to everything in their life. And just find comfort in that space, because it is very comfortable. Many of us had parents that existed in that kind of victim mentality, and it can feel like, you know, a home for people. But at the same time, it is just very disempowering in finding that space to, like I was saying before, get in touch with your own intuition and your own wants and needs. Because wants, expressing your own wants, needs, beliefs, your own path is a space of vulnerability, because you're always in a state of risking being rejected by the other, being, you know, being exposed in that way. You're also, that if you put out an opinion that other people don't like, you kind of have to hold that. And so it's just much easier to be a victim. And our entire society is kind of set up for people to have codependent relationships with their family, with their society, meaning that their value is based on the ways that others, when I say codependence, I'm meaning more of the way that your value is based on the way that others perceive you. So you're just existing in that victim space of, oh, I have to do this because I was told to do this. I have to, you know, and not coming from a space of your sovereign experience of self, where you're putting yourself out there to just try things, to be in a way where you might screw up, you might feel shame, you might feel rejection, and all of those triggered unworthiness, unlovable feelings, but that you're strong enough to give it a try anyway, you know?
I know exactly what you mean. Anything that kind of excuses people from having to think or having to take responsibility, it's really tempting. Like, it is seriously tempting. Like, it kind of takes out of my hands. I don't have to, it's not down to me. Yeah. Very tempting. I know what you mean. Okay, we'll get on to the, I don't know if psychedelic wasn't the word you used. It was...
I did use psychedelic. I also said psychodynamic.
Oh, psychodynamic, okay. Can you tell me a bit just the general, the general idea of using... I suppose like a substance to don't know, kind of have some effect on your mind, but with the aim of therapy from it. Can you tell me a bit about that? Kind of how you got into it even?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of different medicines that are being used and being studied now for mental health issues, for healing, for awakening. I'm working primarily with ketamine in my practice as a tool for that. And I mean, what it does is it allows people to exist with their ego pulled to the side. You know, you really can just look at the stories, the narratives that you've been telling yourself from a different angle, where you're not in such a hardened idea of just this is. You know, you can kind of just say, oh, this is part of me. This is part of my experience. And to rewrite narratives around your own views of yourself, yourself in relation to others, past experiences, things like that. The psychedelic experience is, ketamine is an anesthetic dissociative, but the experience is quite psychedelic. And, you know, they do a lot of things to the brain to help create neuroplasticity and healing aspects of the brain that get really worn down from chronic stress. So it's just kind of can be like a reset for a lot of people. I have a lot of clients who feel like they finally understand maybe some of the spiritual concepts that they've been studying in their life. Like, they feel like they've had an embodied experience of it, which is largely due to just the experience of being in a psychedelic state. is a very in the moment experience, you know, and when your mind starts trying to hold on to things, trying to think, and how am I going to tell this story? You're out of the moment. But you see, when you're in the moment and you're just trusting that what is going to happen, it's going to happen, that you're going to be able to handle what comes next, and you surrender to it, you'll see that the medicine kind of opens up and you really get in this beautiful space of flow. And, you know, for many people who live their lives with a lot of hardened ego functioning and wanting to be in control, and perhaps a lot of anxiety about the future, it's just being in that experience of being in the moment can be so healing. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I don't have to think of 10 steps ahead. I can just exist. And, you know, so that's a really beautiful thing for people to be able to do. And the medicine kind of is the bridge to that space. You can also get to that sort of mindset through meditation, other breathing, breath work, a variety of practices, but the medicine is kind of a nice shortcut to experiencing yourself in that way. That then I describe it with clients. It's like, it opens channels. It shows you how you can be, how you can exist. But then after the integration work that I require with my clients that are doing medicine work, it really is what creates the bridge out of that psychedelic space into your lived experience. And how do you keep those channels open? Because they're not just going to stay open because they were open. You have to be in a space of resetting your mind as your mind starts to go down those spirals, to be able to see, ah, that's my mind spiraling, you know? And one of the big things about working with psychedelic medicines is being able to see your mind as a part of you rather than you. You know, it really takes your ego from being like, just like, this is me, to being like, oh, my ego is a part of me. And so that's huge. And that is a really good breakthrough for people trying to change their behaviors and thoughts.
I see. I think I get kind of what it does. It leaves you in a place where your ego is kind of removed. Is it a case of like getting people to take a little bit and sit and talk to you like in therapy, or kind of spending time with your own thoughts? How does it kind of work?
That is one approach. But in general, my clients are going for a deeper experience where they'll come in and we'll talk a little bit, and then they will lay down, before they lay down, we'll do like a guided meditation while they swish the lozenge, and then they'll lay down with the mask on, put headphones on. And it's a very internal experience. You know, a lot of people with ketamine are like, yeah, I tried ketamine out at the club and I went into a K-hole and it was horrible. And it's like, okay. The thing is, it's kind of like, you're going in my office, they're often kind of going into a K-hole, but with the intention of that. And it's not a negative experience in the same way, because it's like they are going into their mind, you know, and you wouldn't want to be in that deep of a space when you're out in a social setting, which is why people have these horrible experiences, because yes, you really are leaving your body. And that's kind of scary if you're out in a club. But if you're in a therapist's office and you're laying down and you've got a blanket on and your eye mask and your music, you know, you just go inward and have these processes and have, often visual things come up, more physical embodied things, just your mind just works so differently. You can start to just dissolve your ego or parts of it. And then they're in the medicine for an hour and a half, and then come out. And then there's some talking after, but some of my clients want to talk while they're in the medicine, but in general, it's a pretty quiet experience that they have. And then we talk after, and then the next day, within 24 hours, I like to schedule an integration appointment while their mind is still very in that neuroplastic state, to try to really bridge what they experienced to creating those new neural pathways and to allowing them to be more solidified.
Interesting. Okay, so you kind of touched on something like obviously my the only time I'd heard of ketamine before was to be used as like a recreational drug, like a party drug. Is there any I don't know like how much usually like a ketamine taker will take like at a concert or a night out or something, but is there a difference, is there like a difference in like dosing, the amount that like someone out in a club taking ketamine and someone in therapy, is it a case of taking like less or something?
Well, I would hope that people in clubs take less than people that are doing ketamine therapy, because they're just going to be laid out in the club. They, you know, the they my clients get the medicine prescribed, and so they'll work with the medical practitioner around what the right dosing is. And often they'll take an initial dose and then have the option of a booster, like 20 minutes in, so they can kind of get a feel for how it's going. And then usually it's an increase in dosage for subsequent sessions. And I have a lot of clients that do a series of in-office sessions with me. And then once they really get comfortable with the medicine, they'll do at-home self-guided sessions. And I'm just working with them within the 24 hours. We schedule an integration appointment so they can continue the medicine. Because a lot of people like to do it on a weekly basis to really keep their mind in that space.
I see. I see. Is it true? Is it true that ketamine was discovered like originally as a horse tranquilizer? Is that true?
I mean, that is one of its uses. It's been used for a variety of purposes. There's a story that they would give it to people in combat, to give to their comrades if need be, because you can't really overdose on it, or at least it's very, very, very rare. So rather than giving like codeine or something that could be dangerous, it's something that can help with pain, help to relax people. Yeah, so it's used for a variety of things. It's interestingly, they'll use it for people who would come into hospitals being suicidal. They can give them high doses of ketamine. It calms them down, and often kind of then they come out of it and they don't feel so suicidal anymore, just because of the way that it works on the mind, and also perhaps what's happening in their inner journey. I don't know. I heard of somebody having it recently for a C-section, which I think is kind of wild, but it's a very versatile, safe medicine. So it's being used for a lot of different things.
Interesting. You said you said it was safe. No, I don't know. I don't really know anything about it. But like, is it a case that is it a case that like you could take it, kind of regularly or semi-regularly, and it wouldn't have the negative effect on your brain that like I think like if you had cocaine every week or not comparing, but if you had cocaine every week or MDMA every week, that there would be like a definite negative on your mind. Is there like studies like kind of long term or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are studies on that, and like anything, having some moderation is important. If you're doing ketamine every day, that probably wouldn't necessarily be so great for your mind and body. But using it in a way where it's prescribed by a medical provider who's overseeing your treatment, and just to an extent where it's having therapeutic benefits and you're getting something out of it, is generally pretty safe.
Interesting. Have you found has it been the case that you've had clients who are maybe having trouble, who are having trouble with therapy or kind of weren't making progress, and the ketamine made a big difference for them?
Yeah. I mean, it's for especially for people with treatment resistant depression, where so much of that is just the mind gets so rigid in just this idea of this is who I am. It's so many clients, it's just not just clients, people, we have these identities that we have developed for ourselves, and we don't even sometimes see them as identities. It's like, this is what I am, this is how I am, this is how I react to the world. And just you kind of don't believe that there's anything to change because you don't see it as separate from you. It's just like, this is me, So especially for clients with those really treatment resistant depression cases, they can experience themselves in the medicine differently than they've ever seen themselves. Their minds can work completely differently than they had before. And it can really kind of open up some amazing pathways where people can find their creativity, believe that they can heal, you know, because a lot of people just don't even believe that they could ever be better. They're just like, you know, people get these ideas like, I'm wounded, I'm broken, this is just how I am, I'm going to be like this forever. I mean, it's so common. I mean, even among like super high functioning people, we just have these ideas of this is what I am. And to have a medicine that can help you to see yourself as something different and see your mind working in a different way. And then even once the medicine's out of your system, to still see that you have these new channels opened in you, you know, it can make really dramatic shifts. It's not for everybody. Some people don't have amazing experiences. Some people it's kind of, you know, whatever, but for a lot of people, it can be really powerful and a game changer in their self-worth, their self-concepts, and just their overall well-being.
Is it something that you only recommend doing like with a therapist, like in a kind of professional regulated kind of setting? Would you say people using it recreationally, you shouldn't, or?
I mean, I'm not here to tell people what they should or shouldn't do in their lives. I would say that if you have a goal of self-development, of evolving, of becoming your best self, then it's really important that you're focusing on integrating any experience that you have into your day-to-day and trying to really understand the unconscious material that's coming up and how that's affecting you, what it means about who you are and about the ways that you think, feel, behave, and to try, you know, to use these things as tools to grow from. But, you know, everybody's in their own space on their path and is making choices that are what feels right for them in that phase. And I'm definitely not here to judge anybody for anything.
I see. Thank you very much for all your time. I appreciate everything you shared. Very interesting. Really fascinating stuff. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with? Kind of any parting words? Maybe advice from a advice from a therapist on living a more happy, fulfilled life.
Oh, you know what? I have a little practice that I can tell you that I love to share with people that I think is so powerful. So we talked a lot about getting in touch with your own wants and needs. And so I have this simple practice I recommend to people, but it's amazing how it's so hard for some people. It's, you just take a block of time. You can set, I like to sometimes do it for like an entire day or an entire weekend, but you can just do for like an hour. And during that time, you're only doing what you feel like you really want or need to do. And if in your mind you start to say, oh, but I should do this, then you don't do that thing. And you don't allow yourself to think three steps ahead, like, oh, I'm going to take a bath and then I'm going to drink tea and then I'm going to go see my friend. Like, you just are like, what's next? What am I in now? And what do I want to move into? So it's a practice of being really present and really getting back in touch with your own wants and needs. I mean, it's one thing I do see, especially among men, is that they get into relationships very often and then completely lose themselves. They love their partner so much that they just, their entire life becomes, how can I make this my partner happy? What does my partner want me to do right now? And it's this really slippery slope that can often end up in the person losing the thing that they were loved for initially, losing their own individual spark and their passion for life because they're just melding into this other. So riding that ship of getting back into, what do I want? What do I need? Not what should I do or what do other people want of me, is such a powerful practice. And I recommend it to anybody, and it doesn't cost any money. It just takes a little bit of time. And I think it's just a really beautiful way to listen to that intuitive voice. You know, the intuition is like a muscle. And when you don't work it, and in fact, when you suppress it for so long, you can't hear it. But the more that you train yourself to listen to it, the more you can be living your life in, you know, your own truth and in your alignment.
Very interesting. Thank you for that. Can you tell us where we can find you? You have a nice you have a good TikTok page where you give I wouldn't call them talks, but yeah, like little dialogues. Yeah.
I do. I have a website, LeahO'DonnellLCSW.com, and I'm on Instagram at LeahO'DonnellLCSW, ODONNELL.
Very good. Thank you very much again for joining me. I appreciate the time.
This is fun. Thank you.